Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent with Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Internet Global Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind you of some upcoming events. On Wednesday, June 15th, Mstislav Rostropovich, music director of the National Symphony Orchestra, will talk about the current conditions in Russia. On Monday, June 20th, Dan Golden, the NASA administrator, will present a speech entitled Space Exploration and America's Technological Future. And on Thursday, June 23rd, Donna Shalala, Secretary of Health and Human Services, will be on hand to discuss President Clinton's welfare reform proposal that he's presenting today. Audio and videotapes and transcripts of National Press Club lunches are available through the Press Club's library or by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards provided for you at your table and hand them up to me, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called.
You can't hear.
Ooh. Okay. I'll speak up a little bit and I'll see what we can do about that. Starting from your right, Hamilton South of Vanity Fair. Julie Moon of the U.S. Asian News Service. Charles Krause of the McNear Lehrer News Hour. Sandra McElwain, a freelance journalist. Congressman Robert Torricelli, a Democrat from New Jersey's 9th District. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Christy Wise, a freelance journalist and chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Frederica Dunn of the Federal Aviation Administration and the member of the Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Andrew Alexander, Deputy Bureau Chief for Cox Newspapers. Marilee Schwartz of the Washington Post. And Ross Bleckner of Vanity Fair. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdel-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Our speaker today is Bianca Jagger, an icon of the glory days of rock and roll, who has become an international activist in her own right in the cause of peace and human rights. Bianca was born in Nicaragua and received her formal education at the Institute of Political Science in Paris. A model married to a rock star Mick Jagger, she became part of the legendary scene of the 1960s. But for the past 20 years, she has campaigned for human rights throughout the world. She denounced death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala, assisted refugees in Central America, and provided earthquake relief in Nicaragua. She has worked with numerous human rights organizations, such as Amnesty International, Oxfam America, and SHARE. And she has traveled with U.S. congressional fact-finding missions to Central America. She has championed the cause of the indigenous peoples of the South American rainforest, who are being forced from their homelands and killed as the rainforests have been decimated. Last year, Ms. Jagger traveled to the former Yugoslavia to document claims of mass rapings of Muslim women by Serbian forces as part of a systematic campaign of ethnic cleansing. She has testified before the Helsinki Committee of Human Rights and the U.S. Congressional Human Rights Caucus in an effort to stop these atrocities and make the perpetrators accountable to a war crime tribunal. She is a goodwill ambassador of the Albert Schweitzer Institute, and since April of 1993 has been evacuating children out of Bosnia to undergo medical treatment in the United States. In the post-Cold War world, these are the issues that will be shaking the nation's conscience. Millions of refugees now are living in camps to avoid ethnic fighting going on around the world. How the United States responds to those refugees indicates where this country is going to take its international leadership. Activists like Bianca Jagger believe they have to keep piquing our collective conscience. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for Bianca Jagger.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you about the tragedy that the people of Bosnia are suffering today. I must tell you that this is probably more scary for me than going to Bosnia. I want to begin this afternoon with a few brief words about my own involvement in Bosnia. Can you hear me? The atrocities I have seen and why I have come to advocate decisive actions by the United States, the United Nations, and NATO to end those atrocities once and for all. Much of my life has been devoted to causes of human rights, peace, and social justice in my native Central America. When the crisis in the former Yugoslavia began more than 2 years ago, it appeared to be just one more crisis that would concern all of us who are committed to these issues around the world. But it soon became clear that the war in Bosnia was a very different kind of crisis in its magnitude, in its intensity, and in the sheer failure of our political institution to bring about justice or peace. In February of 1993, I was asked to document the mass rapes in Bosnia for the Helsinki Commission. I traveled throughout the former Yugoslavia with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees personnel. I was in Bosnia when the Bosnian government appealed to the UNHCR to get an urgently needed convoy to Šarka, a community of about 35,000 Muslims who had been completely cut off by Serbian forces from food, medicine, and humanitarian relief for almost a year. The Serbs have been refusing to give humanitarian convoys access to more than 200,000 people besieged in Gorozde, Serpa, and Srebrenica. Nothing different than what has continued to happen from then. They do that in order to starve people out of their homes, forcing them to leave or to be killed by indiscriminate shelling, a sniper fire, and blockades that cause starvation and disease. In other words, the strategy known as ethnic cleansing. Early that January, in the town of Srpska, nearly 5,000 civilians on the brink of starvation were forced to evacuate the town by foot along frozen paths through the hills. An unknown number died en route. Others lost fingers and toes due to frostbite. There were reports that thousands more were waiting to come out. There are still thousands more who are desperately waiting to come out today. The conflict in Bosnia-Herzegovina has entailed widespread destruction of life, acts of unspeakable brutality, killing, mutilation, and disappearances. In their attempt to create ethnically clean Serbian territories and to exterminate non-Serbian populations, the Serbs established a great number of concentration camps, gathering centers and prisons for the torture and murder of the non-Serbian civilian population in the municipalities where Muslims and Croats had once been the majority. The aggressor pursues thousands of civilians who are captured in the streets, houses and schools, and brought to the factories, warehouses, garage, hotels, distribution centers, railway station, oil pits, mines, and other facilities that are used as camps. Many are beaten to death with chains and sticks and metal rollers, castrated and burned alive by the Serbs. I know that maybe what I'm telling you is too descriptive, But I want to convey to you some of what I underwent when I was there. The majority of the captives are civilians who survive terrorist attacks on the towns and settlements, after which they are taken by force to large stadiums and other facilities and selected according to the nationality and age, men separated from women and children. By this ethnic cleansing, the aggressor changes the demographic structure of Bosnia-Herzegovina, thus realizing his plan to create a greater Serbia. He plans to establish the Serbian state within the occupied territories from which he has forcibly displaced the Muslims and Croats. Liquidation of captives and prisoners has been well documented. Many civilians have been taken from these camps to unknown destinations, and many have been starved to death. The television images that you have seen of those men's live quarters, eyed wide open with illness and hunger, have shocked the entire world. Many look like Nazi concentration camp victims from the Second World War. Following my trip, although I do believe that there were cases of rape that were committed by the other side, I am convinced that systematic mass rapes were used by the Serbs against Muslim women as a weapon of war. The report of the United Nations Commission on War Crimes in Bosnia endorsed this view, and state that it is not unreasonable to estimate the number of rapes at 20,000. Although I witnessed unspeakable horrors in Central America, the horrors I witnessed in Bosnia against the European people, the random shelling, the rapes, and the abuses have brought the brutality of the Nazi regime into our time. No one could live through this kind of experience without being transformed and committed to do something about this. That's what I'm here to speak to you, even though this is a nerve-wracking experience. As a woman and as a mother, my first instinct was to save children. I went back in March of 1993, and for nearly 6 weeks, I endured shelling by the Serbian army. The indifference of the United Nations and the confusion of an escalating war to save two children who were desperately ill. I was asked by Dr. Sunik while I was visiting a pediatric ward in Tuzla to evacuate Sabina, a little girl of 12. She was suffering from a form of leukemia, which if treated on time, has a 90% survival rate. And the little boy, Mohammed, suffering from a congenital heart problem, which can only be corrected by surgery. The Tuzla Hospital could not provide adequate medical treatment for these two children. They were condemned to die if they stayed in Tuzla. Consistent with Serbian policy of shelling hospitals and school, the Tuzla Hospital had been a target. To protect the children, the pediatric ward was transferred to the windowless basement of the building. The ward was filled with amputee children. Prostheses were not available. I have an image seared into my memory, a mother from Jerpa pushing a wheelchair with two little girls. Each had a leg amputated. The operation had been performed by a medical assistant with a hacksaw and without anesthesia. While I was in Bosnia, I was able to speak to doctors who perform thousands of operations without anesthesia, with hacksaw, without electricity, sometimes in the open air. That continues to go on in Bosnia today. I requested that Sabina and Mohammed be transported in an Amprofor helicopter, and despite my limited access to the outside world, we managed to get formidable humanitarian efforts behind Sabina and Mohammed. Evacuation to America was arranged by Harold Robles from the Albert Schweitzer Institute, and he arranged for hospital and medical treatment in the United States. Congressman Bob Torricelli and his staff worked tirelessly to help us obtain the visas and made innumerable phone calls to plead with Amprofor to please give us a helicopter. But that was to no avail. But although we met all the requirements set by AMPROFOR, they refused to provide the helicopter. They demanded an evacuation endorsement from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and from the International Committee for the Red Cross. Both were granted, but this wasn't enough for AMPROFOR. Up to the last minute, they claimed the facts from UNHCR had not arrived. All the while, Sabina was losing hope and her will to live. She was weakening, unable to eat or get out of bed. She will force herself to smile when I mention America and the helicopters. We understood each other. There were only three words we could speak to each other. One was America, the other one was helicopter, and the other one was dobra, which means good in Bosnia or in Serbo-Croatian. I realized there were only two options left, either let her die in Tuzla or evacuate her by land. We set out on a harrowing two-day journey. By the time we arrived in Vitesse, Sabina was bleeding from her nose and vomiting blood. 3 days after we arrived in Split, she suffered from brain hemorrhaging, fell into a coma, and died. A 40-minute helicopter ride 3 weeks early could have saved Sabina's life. It is the same case for many other children that are dying today in Bosnia. Mohammed came back with me to the United States, and after undergoing heart surgery at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, he lived with me for 8 months before we were able to bring his family to the United States. He's now living in Hackensack and is going to school in the United States. While the politicians debate, people are dying. 200,000 have died already. Almost 20,000 children have died, as many children as combatants. 2 million Bosnians have been forced out of their homes. When I was in Bosnia, people will come to me and ask me, why has President Clinton forgotten us? I told them that the United States will not bear witness to genocide and not take steps to stop it. But today, more than a year later, the atrocities continue, and we are no closer to a real lasting peace in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Dante wrote that the darkest place in hell is reserved for those who in a period of crisis claim neutrality. If that is true, maybe the United States has slowly descended into a dark place. Let's take a brief look at some of the key events. I believe the failure of our policy and ultimately the failure of our morality will become clear. The entire crisis was foreshadowed when the Serbs attacked Croatia in 1991, firing more than 1 million shells into Vukovar and crushing the entire city. Neither the United States nor its allies took action. Nor did they take action when the Serbs began their campaign against the Bosnians. This is really the fault of the Bush administration. When Sarajevo first came under siege in the summer of 1992, air power could have been used to get rid of Serbian artillery, stopping the shelling of Sarajevo and carrying a powerful message to the Serbs. Even NATO's Supreme Commander, General Galvin, believed that is something we should have tried, but we did not. Since that time, Americans' policy toward Bosnia has been a string of false promises and hollow threats. The UN created a corridor for humanitarian aid and supplies, the kind that are desperately needed by Bosnia in every part of the country. But the corridor has not been kept open. And my own experience show the great difficulties in obtaining the most basic food and medicine, even for small children. The United Nations designated 6 safe areas that I call safe havens that will be protected by all necessary means, including the use of force. But these areas ended up as legitimized concentration camps, unprotected from aggression and cut off from all help and supplies. Even though NATO air strikes were initially successful, shooting down 4 Serbian planes in a no-fly zone and helping to stop shelling of civilians in Sarajevo, President Clinton made it clear that the United States had no interest in changing the military balance in Bosnia. That is, no interest in helping the victims of aggression. The result was that the Serb pressed ahead. The UN Security Council voted to create a tribunal by those accused of war crimes, but more than a year had passed before a top prosecutor was named. Peace talks in London and Geneva has centered around the United Nations effort to adopt the British approach of divide and govern. Instead of responding to naked aggression, the UN-sponsored efforts have repeatedly offered concessions and rewards to the aggressor, further victimizing the victims. The Bosnians, to their great credit, have consistently refused this kind of settlement. The Bosnian government had in the past been willing to negotiate peace unconditionally because they believed the promise of the International Conference of the former Yugoslavia that those peace talks will abide by the basic principles setting forth in the London Conference of August of 1992, which were support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Bosnia-Herzegovina, no rewarding of aggression, no endorsement of a partition of Bosnia so that displaced Muslims and Croats could one day return to their homes, no recognition of borders that had been changed by force, and above all, an end to genocide and an end to ethnic cleansing. But in reality, no one of these points was ever kept. Peace talks have not stopped or even slowed Serbian aggression. On the contrary, they have legitimized it. The result of this approach is clear, but failing to exact punishment on the Serbs by failing to extend a credible threat of military punishment or even a hard line at the bargaining table, we ended up with a policy of appeasement. The French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy has quoted and correctly said, has called this the mentality of Munich, the mentality of appeasement and compromise with evil that led us to underestimate and even encourage Hitler before the Second World War. The Serbs have no reason to fear the United States, the UN, or NATO, because our threats have rarely been backed with force. They have no reason to negotiate, since their failure to do so has had little consequence for them, and most painfully for the people of Bosnia. The Serbian aggressor have no reason to observe the 24 ceasefire that have been tried and failed. Their aggression has actually advanced the goal, since the US and the UN seems inclined to go to a settlement that leaves much of their spoils untouched. The mortar shell that killed 68 people in Sarajevo shopping market in February was the only proof that we needed to know that the ceasefire couldn't hold. Now there is evidence that the Serbs are breaking a ceasefire that began on June the 10th. The bottom line is simple. When we condemn the Serbs without punishing them, when we talk about NATO's power but are afraid to use it, when we claim neutrality in the face of hostility, we encourage the Serbs to be more aggressive, and we shatter any chance at real lasting peace. Meanwhile, each and every day, the carnage continues. The toll of genocides mounts. Those who believe we shouldn't take serious actions in Bosnia say that we don't want blood on our hands. Well, the blood may not be in our hands, but it is already in our conscience. And if Bosnia has been a failure of our morality, it has been a profound failure of our international integrity as well. NATO, whose very purpose is safety and security throughout Europe, has failed in that basic mission, even though it has both the force and the credibility to bring the Serbs to submission. The Serbs deliberately provoked NATO when they attacked the defenseless city of Gorazde, but America made it clear that there were limits to the US response and that it will not become fully engaged, even if that meant the takeover of the city. When it comes to the United Nations, the failures have been even more blatant. by failing to protect the borders of Bosnia, a nation it admitted as a member just a few years ago, the United Nations is actually violating its own charter. At the same time, the UN's enforcement of a one-side arms embargo violates Bosnia's right to self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter. The embargo also violates Security Council resolution to ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid, to ensure the protection of personnel delivering humanitarian aid, and to protect populations in UN safe areas. It has protected the Serbian advantage in heavy artillery, since the Serbs enjoy free and easy access to weapons from the Belgrade regime. That is why they have been able to capture more than 70% of all Bosnian territory and one-third of the territory of Croatia. Ironically, out of 40 United Nations Security Council resolutions, most dealing with matters such as safe areas and humanitarian aid to Bosnia, the only one fully and aggressively implemented is the embargo. What an irony. The embargo is simply illegal, and the United States should unilaterally end it in accordance with international law. Meanwhile, there is talk of easing sanctions against Serbia to encourage them to stop their aggression. This is a great irony as well. Sanctions imposed to punish aggression may now be removed to reward aggression. Where does it end? Will international peacekeepers want to keep the result of ethnic cleansing and ratify the Serb crimes against humanity? And what about the United States itself? There has been a clear absence of commitment, of leadership. Imagine if the US has taken that same stance in World War II. Imagine if America had turned its back on the killing, the injustice, the indignity. America will have traded away everything this nation stands for. And there is a danger of doing that today. It is not too late to win back credibility. It is not too late to prevent more bloodshed, more brutality in Bosnia. I believe there are four ways to start. First, there is only one way to win back the credibility of the United States, NATO and the United Nations. In fact, there is only one way to keep that credibility in any crisis and in any circumstances, and that is resolved. No more flip-flops, no more false promises, no more violations of the UN Charter. Let's say what we mean and mean what we say. That means no more rewarding to aggression, no more treating Milosevic and Karadzic as legitimate partners in a peace process when they are the agents of genocide, no more beating the Bosnian into submission, forcing them to give up land that is rightfully theirs. And above all, the United Nations must have a mandate for peacemaking, not for peacekeeping, since there is no peace to keep. Second, President Clinton must understand what leadership really means. If he keeps searching for the perfect consensus among NATO members, if he refuses to put America's resource behind its threat, Bosnia will be obliterated before we even know where he stands. The United States must lead, and it must challenge others to follow. NATO can still be a credible threat. The military balance can be changed if we are willing to act now. Third, we need policies that are not merely theoretical, but viable in today's Bosnia. It is time to lift the illegal one-sided arms embargo, which should never have been enforced in the first place. It is time to give Bosnia a chance to defend themselves. We must stop forcing a peace that leaves them isolated in small pockets of land. We must reject any thought of partitioning the state along ethnic lines, and we must recognize the inviolability of Bosnian borders. Borders that cannot be changed by force. Otherwise, we promote force as a legal and legitimate tool of international relations. And that means the Serb have to relinquish most of the land they have captured through their military might. Finally, war criminals must be brought to justice. unless the criminals are held accountable, the entire Serbian nation will bear responsibility throughout history. President Clinton has said that America cannot afford to ignore conflicts in Europe. And in this crisis, this nation has a direct interest. But his actions don't live up to these words. Bosnia is a dramatic demonstration of an emerging Clinton doctrine that America cannot bear the burden of leadership, the unmistakable result of loss of purpose and influence abroad. But when human lives are at stake, when people are being exiled from their homes and killed in concentration camps because of who they choose to worship, the real question is, how can we afford not to lead? The real question is what we will do when the aggression spreads to every nation, where a handful of thugs want to expand the land or seize the reign of power. The real question is how we will live with the blood of Bosnia on its conscience after working so hard to keep it off our hands. If America fails to take meaningful action, the new world order dissolves into disorder. If it fails to act, it risks the entire credibility of the US, the UN, and NATO, and it reduces our internal international organization to study groups, content to monitor atrocities, but powerless to stop them. The world may not have noticed when Bosnia crisis began, but I'm sure we will not forget when it ends. The world is a very different place because of what has happened in Bosnia. Confidence in our most trusted institution has been shattered. Our hopes for the post-World War have been cast into doubt. International order is on trial. Profound questions have been raised about the ability of the United States to manage global events and provide leadership to the family of nations. Perhaps the biggest irony of all is that if we fail in Bosnia, the victim are not just the Bosnian people who die from violence and indifference, but also ourselves. The message will not be lost on those who challenge international justice and international order, from Korea and Azerbaijan to Haiti and Rwanda. If we let that happen, may God forgive us all. Thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a very passionate appeal. We have many questions here, and I'll start with the first one, which was, then should U.S. troops be part of a U.N. contingent in Bosnia, and what would that accomplish? And this questioner asked that you also answer that in Spanish.
Sure.
Briefly, because we have a radio audience that
I, as you know, maybe never promote intervention in other countries. Therefore, I can understand the feeling of American people not to send troops to Bosnia. But I feel that if we lift the embargo and we are able to use air strikes and we make sure that supplies for weapons do not continue to flow from Belgrade, then we could find an answer to the problem in Bosnia. Lo que dije en inglés fue que yo nunca he promovido la intervención extranjera en otros países. Por eso no estoy segura que yo quisiera que sería la solución de enviar tropas a Bosnia. Pero si levantamos el embargo y si al mismo tiempo se hacen ataques aéreos de NATO, yo creo que se puede encontrar una solución para el problema de Bosnia.
Thank you. The argument against ending the embargo is that it would take months to get arms to Bosnia, they would be difficult to get to the right forces, and difficult to use without proper training. Lifting the embargo would entice the Serbs to greater use of force before all this can happen. How do you respond to those?
Well, first of all, I'd like to make a clarification for you. There are three factions within Bosnia. even though the Bosnian Muslims don't like to be called Bosnian Muslim, because as you know, they are composed of Bosnian Muslims, Croats and Serbs, even within the government of Bosnia. But you have the Serbs who are providing Serbia, who is providing weapons to the Serbs inside Bosnia, and the Croats who have been providing weapons to the Bosnian Croats inside Bosnia. Therefore, what you have is a really an imbalanced force with the Bosnian people, because they have no access for weapons. Let's let them decide how long it will take them to get the weapons inside the country to defend themselves. They keep telling us that they don't want American boys to come and die in Bosnia. All they want is the right to defend themselves. And I do not feel that the Serbs could increase the amount of weapons that they have. They have a formidable army already in fighting in Bosnia. In fact, I think that the Serbs have probably either the fourth or the fifth largest army in Europe today.
This questioner says, or asks, how can President Clinton be prepared to use force in Bosnia when Congress is so resistant to committing troops or airstrikes?
Well, I think that we just saw recently the vote in Congress that asked to lift the embargo in Bosnia. I am not here advocating the use of force or the use of troops. I think that it's been great discussions as to whether NATO should do the airstrike, and in fact, they have done it in the past. So what I'm only advocating today is that it has to be done effectively, and it has to be done decisively so that we can see the result of these actions.
This questioner says, you are quite critical of President Clinton's handling of Bosnia. Do you believe Presidents Bush or Reagan would have offered more decisive leadership?
No, I do not believe. And I think, in fact, I opposed the policies of Bush and Reagan in Central America. The only reason was that I believed, like many other people, that President Clinton really meant the promises that he made during his campaign.
Then can President Clinton take strong action in Bosnia-Herzegovina without turning the U.S. into the policeman of the world?
That is a question that is difficult to answer. But I think that I said it during my speech. The question is, will the Bosnia crisis in the end turn now to be a signal to all the extremists of the world who want to repeat the Bosnia case? If that is so, and there is not a leadership from this country, I don't know what the world will be in the future.
How has the end of the Cold War changed the stability of individual nations and reshaped national borders?
Well, I think that the sad part of the ending of the Cold War is that I think we all have tremendous hopes on what the future had reserved for us. But the way we see things today, what is happening in Rwanda, what is happening in Haiti, what is happening in the rest of the world, does not give us a very promising future. And I think that more than ever, the institutions such as the United Nations would have to play a very important role to keep order in the world. Maybe it is not the United States who has to be the peacekeeper of the world, or the police of the world, but we will have to strengthen the UN so that the UN can really fulfill that role.
Tell us more about your efforts to bring children out of Bosnia for medical treatment, and then should this program be expanded to allow more children out?
As I told you when I was in Bosnia, and I wanted to just said a small detail, in many places in Bosnia, or maybe the majority, there are no phones. The only phones that are available are satellite phones. So one day I made a phone call to a friend of mine who said to me, you must talk to a man called Harold Robles, who is the chairman of the Albert Schweitzer Institute. And I begged him to help me to evacuate these two children. And And he began working on trying to get a hospital for Sabina and Mohammed. And finally, in the end, I was, as I told you in my story, able to bring Mohammed. Since then, I have worked with him and with other human rights organizations as well on bringing children to the United States. It has not been an easy task. It's been extremely difficult, first to get anyone to move them from the place that they are ill or in the hospitals where they are so they could be brought to Zagreb. From Zagreb, then we have to get them visas so they'd be allowed into the United States. I must say that's not been the most difficult thing. I will point it out that after I brought Mohammed, Mr. Peter Tarnoff was very kind in helping us bring Mohammed's family to be reunited with Mohammed in the United States. We have up to now been able to, with the help of Bob Torricelli, to bring children that are living today. Some are in Hackensack and they are receiving treatment for leukemia. Others are in New York and they're living at the McDonald House. And some underwent surgery at the hospital in New York, Columbia Presbyterian, who saved the life of Mohammed. And sometimes we encounter red tape to bring them out. It has not been the most easy thing, and I wish that I was able to do more. But as you know, it is not easy to come out or to go inside Bosnia-Herzegovina.
You've often mentioned that the UN should be strengthened. How would you go about doing it? How would you strengthen the United Nations?
Someone was telling me the other day that maybe the whole of the UN was no more than the amount of people that live in Kansas City. And I think one of the things that are important is there you have troops that have to go to areas such as Bosnia or Rwanda that probably need to be better trained. I think that the whole approach of what it needs to be done has to be redefined because more and more what they're doing has to do with countries that are torn by war. And I feel that as well, a question of whether those nations really have the decision making to really help. For example, you have a case in Bosnia where the mandate today is a peacekeeping mandate. Well, that means that when they're trying to bring the convoys of humanitarian aid, then in fact to defend it, they will not be allowed. They will need to have a mandate of peacemaking in Bosnia, and that will require, of course, that they will have to fire if the humanitarian aid is not being allowed, and that they will have to establish order inside that country. I think that all of that has to be very carefully addressed and a redefinition, which I will not claim to be an expert, but that from my experience inside Bosnia, I feel can be a lot better than what it is today.
Moving to a different part of the world. You were recently in El Salvador and Nicaragua. Do you think the U.S. is now playing a constructive role in Central America?
I will say so. I will say that, you know, for 10 years I fought the Bush and the Reagan administration on Nicaragua. In particular, in the last 8 years, I fought the Contra War. I feel that what is happening today in El Salvador is promising. They just had free elections, and although there are still some question about whether impunity will still pervade in their society, there are some very encouraging signs. I do hope that the opposition will be able to be kept alive, and that the United States will maintain the sort of policies that they have in the last few months. And with respect to Nicaragua, unfortunately, the situation in Nicaragua has not improved. I wouldn't say that that is the fault of the United States. I will say that it is unfortunately a sad state of affairs where the hope that the Nicaraguan people has set on the government of Mrs. Chamorro has not completely been fulfilled. And I hope that things will become better, even if though at the very moment there is a debate in the National Assembly of Nicaragua about a military law that, if passed the way it has been proposed and agreed between Mrs. Chamorro government and the general of the armed forces in Nicaragua, a person that you may all know, General Ortega, it will in some ways bring back some of what we had during the Somoza regime, except that in this case, it will probably be with the seal of legality, where the army will be able to participate in business, and furthermore, the army will have tax exemption, who will give a very disloyal competition to the private sector in Nicaragua.
What will you be showing about Nicaragua in the documentary that you are producing?
I will be showing the aftermath of the revolution, what happened at the end of the Cold War, our Cold War in Nicaragua. Have the hopes for democracy in Nicaragua have been fulfilled? The problem in Nicaragua continues to be the issue of property law. Land is today at the core of the problem in most of Central American countries, especially in Nicaragua and in El Salvador. It's a very complex idea. I wanted to do a documentary over a period of a few years. I filmed the first 2 years of after Mrs. Chamorro was inaugurated, and I hope that I will be able to film the ending of her period in power, and that I will come to some conclusion that will give me more in-depth answers as to the problem that the Nicaraguans and the rest of Central America has to find solutions for.
This questioner says there is still much to be learned about CIA complicity in Central American death squads, which is obviously what you have been protesting. If it is shown that individuals in the CIA were involved, should they be prosecuted for murder?
I think that all crimes should be accountable, whether it is in the CIA or in a government or in any place. I don't see why we should make any exceptions.
We have, of course, several problems dealing with Haiti. What would you advise President Clinton to do about restoring democracy in Haiti and stop the killing there? Is there a role for Aristide? Should there be a role for Aristide? And how would you handle the refugee problem from Haiti? Is he doing the right thing now?
Haiti is probably, like it is probably for many among you, the issue of Bosnia, a very difficult issue for me to understand and to come to terms with what the solutions are for Haiti. I have no doubt in my mind that we should do everything so that President Aristide should be restored to Haiti. With respect to American intervention, you know that I do not favor interventions in any place, especially in Latin America. And my fear will be not so much the intervention, but what will be the aftermath of that intervention, how long it will last, how will they be able to leave the country. Remember that many of these countries have had invasions in the past, so the memories of U.S. intervention still remains in their minds. And with respect to the refugees, and I know that maybe some of you have some questions after that, I feel that not only the United States, but other countries should give refuge to the refugees. It's not only America that is refusing to accept refugees from Haiti. Latin America, countries in the Caribbean, they're not all coming forward to accept the refugees. So it is a very, very difficult question where I don't think the burden should be only put on the United States.
Do you think, though, that the United States has has taken on its share of the burden so far by refusing to allow the Haitian refugees in. Is the United States not protecting itself more than many other countries already are doing in other parts of the world?
Morally, I feel that probably the refugees should be given asylum, but I feel that other countries, that people in Latin America and people in the Caribbean should be doing the same.
Now, the situation in Rwanda is starting to make Bosnia look like a cakewalk here. What is there a role there? I mean, how far can the United States go in a country that is so far removed from American interests in protecting its own nation, its own citizens from killing each other?
As I was saying before about the end of the Cold War, I feel that we need to make a redefinition of the relationship between the northern and southern countries. If the world is going to be, from now on, is going to have examples like Rwanda and like Bosnia, we have to find solutions. We have to redefine what countries, what institutions have to do. I am not an expert in Rwanda, and I will not pretend to know what the answers should be or what the United States should do. I have never been there, and therefore, I don't like to speak about things that I am not firsthand, don't have firsthand knowledge.
You spoke very movingly about the plight of the children in Bosnia. Is there anything that Americans can do, any places to contribute to any organizations that are helping the Bosnian children?
There are many organizations that are helping people in Bosnia. I wish I could give you many other names. The Albert Schweitzer Institute is in Connecticut, and they have done a tremendous work in helping not only sick children, but as well helping inside Bosnia. There is as well Veteran for Peace that helps the refugees, and there is Brothers Brothers, another organization that helps people in Bosnia.
This questioner asks, would you comment on the human rights situation in Mexico? Can the demands of the Zapatistas be satisfied by the current government? Will the election this summer be fair? Is there anything the U.S. can do to assure a fair election?
Well, I just came back from Mexico, and maybe you don't know, but I do a lot of work with indigenous tribes in Latin America. And I wanted to visit Mexico and Chiapas because the Zapatistas are, the base of their support are indigenous people in that country. One of the things that was clear to me is that the treaty, which I think many people in this country have a misperception of what it is. Although the treaty has had a tremendous progressive position in foreign policy in all of Latin America, it has been the only party that has been elected in Mexico for the last 60 years. They are human rights violation in Mexico, and in fact, I feel that the voice of the Zapatistas was really based on the fact that the indigenous people had been oppressed and had had no voice in the history of that country. I don't believe that there will be a peaceful settlement before the election, since they feel that unless they know who the next government is going to be, and since there's going to be an election that they hope will be fair, that it will be no point to negotiate with the party that is today in power, but rather with whoever is going to be elected after these elections, these forthcoming elections in Mexico.
Okay, we are almost out of time here, but before asking the last question, I would like to present you with a, certainly something that you need, a National Press Club mug and a certificate of appreciation for being here. It's gotten buried under all these papers here, but certificate of appreciation for being here, which I hope is in here. Anyway, we have a nice envelope here with your name on it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to be with you. I hope that I was not too serious or too nervous. Thank you very much.
But, for our last question, I'd like to describe a little bit about your personal journey, how you went from the glittering world of rock and roll in the 1960s. 70s. into your involvement in refugee issues and human rights. Tell us a little, and whatever happened to Mick, anyway.
I think you should answer that question. Well, you know, I was born in Nicaragua, which I think can explain to you much of what I stand for and what I believe. I think a lot of people sometimes forget that I come from a country that, you know, has been torn by wars, you know, through the years. I left Nicaragua to go to Paris to study political science. That was what I intended to do in my life. I got married and I got sidetracked for those years that I was married. And by the end of my marriage, it was as well the revolution in Nicaragua. And I worked with the British Red Cross to help the refugees or the victims of the war in Nicaragua. Previous to that, I had had a very important experience, which was in 1972. There was an earthquake in Nicaragua, and I came back 2 days after to look for my parents, and I had to walk through the rubbles of that country, and I couldn't find them, but I was able, after that, looking for them, to realize the oppression and the horror that Somoza had subjected the people of Nicaragua to. And I finally found my mother, but I think that political lesson that I learned during the earthquake was really what shaped the way I think today. Later on, after I was in Nicaragua during the war and the Sandinistas came to power and led many thousands of people around the world, hoped that the revolution was going to bring change of social justice to this country, which of course, unfortunately, later on, where I became disappointed, like many people around the world did. One day I was asked to go to a refugee camp in Honduras to visit a refugee camp of Salvadorian refugees who had crossed the border from El Salvador into Honduras to avoid the shelling that and the killing that the death squads were committing against them. Whilst I was there on a congressional delegation, a group of 40 men with bandanas, very well armed, they were members of the death squad from El Salvador, came across the border into the refugees to abduct them, to take them back, to kill them in El Salvador. They came in, they tied their thongs behind their back, and they went off along a riverbed. And the relief workers, the members of this congressional group and myself had to decide very quickly what to do about it. And what we did was, all we had were cameras, is we decided we will follow them. And all the women and the children came along with us and follow us, screaming, you know, the names of the husbands and pleading with the death squads to let them go. There were moments in which we didn't know if we were all going to be killed. For some unbeknown reason to us, and maybe God was with us, when we were getting very close to the death squads, they turn around and they say to each other, because we could hear them, you know, we were so close, you know, what will we do, should we kill them all? And they decided to go off, let the refugees back, and I came back to this country and testified about that incident. To having had, if you want, maybe the chance to have been there, to have helped save some of those lives, changed my life. And I felt that individuals can make a difference. And it has been my philosophy ever since then that one person can do something to save a life. It all depends whether you're really committed to doing it. And that's all I've done. I have gone to places where I felt that I could contribute in some ways, that I could help save the life of someone. And probably the most rewarding experience I ever had in my life was to have helped save the life of that little boy, Mohammed. And that means a world to me. Thank you.
Listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.